You're listening to a podcast by BI Norwegian Business School.
Welcome back to Stay Ahead, a BI Norwegian Business School podcast. This episode is part of Strategy as Practice series, where practice meets theory and theory meets practice. Today's topic is incumbents in a fast-changing environment. And today, I have the pleasure of having with me Chief Executive Officer of DNB, Kjerstin Braathen. Kjerstin started her career at DNB in 1999, working in various senior positions serving large corporate clients within shipping, offshore, and logistics. In 2017, she became the CFO of the group, which she held until she was appointed the CEO in 2019. Kjerstin holds today several non-executive positions, and among them, the chair of boards in Vipps, the Nordic payment infrastructure provider. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Thomas.
I'm also joined by Espen Andersen, Associate Professor in Strategy and Entrepreneurship at BI since 1996. Research areas are technology, strategy, innovation, digitalization, and machine learning. Espen has more than 20 years in international consulting in technology and business strategy experience. Espen holds an MSc in economics from BI Norwegian Business School and a Doctor of Business Administration in Management Information Systems from Harvard Business School. Welcome, Espen.
Thank you very much, Thomas.
My name is Thomas Borgen, and I'm an industrial PhD candidate at the Department of Strategy and Entrepreneurship here at BI, and will be your host today. Kjerstin. Before we start, I have to ask you, you had your time inside university studying a bachelor in economics as MSc in management, actually in France. Tell us, why did you study there, and have you kept your French up to speed?
My French is still quite good, even though I probably couldn't talk very much about my job in French, unfortunately. But it was actually a series of coincidences, because my plan was to study in Norway, and then I didn't, my grades weren't good enough. So then I changed my plans, and I am a curious person, I like to think, and I had never learned French, but I liked the sound of the language, and I figured out, let's go to France for a year. And so I did, and I enjoyed it so much that I figured out that I'd stay and start doing my studies there, which was much tougher in the first year than actually just going to a language school. But eventually, the language was good enough for me to continue, and I ended up doing all of the studies there, which taught me one thing. I think it's important to be ambitious, but ambition lies in searching development, at least it does for me, and not making a plan as to where I'm going to be in 5 years, because there's so many plans and there's so many roads that will take you to where you need to go.
I think this is a topic we need to search more about, because I think you have many listeners, including students, because you said a couple of things that, first of all, you didn't have good enough grades. Here you end up as a CEO. So something happened during your time at university and the way you kind of have performed later. But what's your advice then to students today?
My advice is exactly, I think, what I talked about. Be a bit relaxed about what your next move is. It's just not only one move that is the right one. I find that with the young people joining DNB as well. They're so eager to hear advice as to what they need to learn more about, what should be their next move. And there are just so many options and alternatives. It's about keep moving, being curious, continue to develop. Your learning is, in today's society, you need to continue to learn throughout life, because you're not going to end up working with the same thing you studied anyway.
Yeah, exactly. So, interesting. Espen, I mean, Harvard, MIT, Tufts, Boston University, Northeastern, Bentley, Babson, I could go on. You know, all famous university within the metropolitan area of Boston. I mean, you spent quite a lot of time there. You've also been now a lecturer for more than 20 years. What do you believe we could or should learn from a cluster like in the Boston area?
Well, I actually spent some time with the Chamber of Commerce over there, and they tried to analyze what does it take to create such a thing. And, universities is one thing because that produces much of the knowledge. You need money, competent capital, and Boston is one of the largest venture capital cities in the world, if not the largest. It needs to be an attractive place to live. That's extremely important because people working in these areas can live anywhere they want, and they would need to want to live there. And it needs to be tolerant because creative people come in many shapes and forms. And there also needs to be a tight link between these components. You also need a regulatory environment that encourages innovation. And I think Oslo and Norway has a lot of these things. If there is one thing that I think we could learn is that there is a much more tight and natural integration between academia and business in the Boston area and in the United States in total. And I think that's the one thing that I see a big difference between the Boston area and Oslo.
And that's why we're very glad that we have Kjersted here as a CEO.
Precisely. Yeah. I think we're doing something towards that goal.
Yeah, thank you. But thanks for sharing. But let's now more into today's topic. Most of our audience will probably know DNB, Norway's largest financial service group and one of the largest in Nordic region in terms of market capitalization, offering a full range of financial services. If it's loan, savings, asset management, advisory services, insurance and pensions for retail and corporate customers. But how does an incumbent, with a balance sheet of, I think, some more than 3,000 billion Norwegian kroner, 9,000 employees, numerous business lines and activities, remain a leader in a fast-changing environment? But let's take a step back now, Kjersten, and DNB is unquestionably a sizable and very important actor in the Norwegian society and a systematically important financial institution. If one can predict the development of the Norwegian economy, can you then predict the performance of DNB? Or I could put the question the other way around. How do you support the long-term sustainable development of the countries or sectors you're part or involved in?
Oh, there is definitely a strong link between financial institutions and the economy and the environment and the society, but it's not sufficient or necessarily what makes you do well or not well. I think having a leading position in Norway and the fact that Norway is a robust, well-working environment is beneficial. To DNB, but you have to continuously make the right strategic choices and do the right things anyway. I think the world is full of stories where people haven't succeeded in a benign environment and they have succeeded in a not so benign environment. And being 200 years old, I'm sure we have experienced both of them on several occasions. I think increasingly, of course, we always live what I call a common destiny with the society and the economy. And you need to understand what is expected of you. And delivering on customers' expectations, but also in a harmony, in a way with the society is extremely important. I think one of the examples of that is how we have been targeting startup companies. Several years ago, back in 2013, when I had the pleasure of taking on the leadership of working with our SME customers, we saw that our services weren't good enough for SME companies. In fact, services of others weren't good enough for SME companies. And we needed more startups. We needed the innovation. We needed the ecosystem that Espen was talking about to work in order to increase future business potential and future innovation in the Norwegian society. What could we do? Not so much about finance. That's what people think about lending money. But it's not about that. The friction you meet when you start a business, you're there taking the biggest choice of your life. You need to meet someone that actually helps you on the way, takes away some of the hinders. We actually wrote up a very easy book with steps. This is what you should do, because what they're good at is what their idea is about and how they should do to develop that. They're not experts in terms of how to start a company, but as a bank, there's lots of things we can help them with in that direction. So that's just one example.
That's a super example, actually. But I have to continue with you, Kerstin, because of course, as you said, you are a part of the societies, the economies you are serving, or the sectors you're serving. But actually, you also launched a new corporate strategy in the middle of the pandemic. What's the key takeaways and learnings from that? And how was that actually being done in practice?
Well, we were already in a process working on a new strategy when the pandemic hit. This was important to us because it gave us a fuel to continue with a high pace of change. I've talked to so many business owners saying that the period of the pandemic has been about just keeping business up and running. We were almost ready to launch. We launched a new strategy 2 months into the pandemic. It has helped us keep the pace of change up and even increase the pace of change. But I think 2 years after the pandemic, what do we see? Pace of change has actually accelerated. Two main trends that everyone talk about: increased pace of digitization, no doubt about that, and also the trend of sustainability that has really increased in terms of pace. We had our first experience of actually launching the strategy simultaneously to all of our 9,000 plus employees because we did it digitally. And I think for us as an organization, for the managers, for people working remote, working from home, having very clear priorities, seeing the importance of the work they were doing, that gave us a lot of fuel and energy to really perform during a time that has been challenging for many.
Very interesting. Espen, I mean, you do a lot of research on digitalization and how it needs to be a part of, I think, the business DNA.
Yep.
Could you elaborate?
Yeah, for me, the world is very, very simple. It contains sort of, at least in my work, I think about three things: technology, the business environment, and the company strategy. The technology changes, and that influences the business environment, what you can do and what you can't do, and that forces you to change your strategy. And I think the challenge for large incumbents very much is, how do you become aware of and do things with the new technology before it shows up in the business environment? Because by the time it shows up in the business environment, you start to see the effect of it on your accounts, on your profitability or your sales or new competitors springing up. Then, you know, you better already have done some work. So if you think of these things as two sort of three circles: technology, the business environment, and strategy. And there's an arrow from technology to the business environment and then down to strategy. I'm working on that from technology to strategy arrow and say, how can you change your strategy as a result of technological possibilities before you're forced to by the environment? And that's hard to do just for small companies. It's even harder to do in an existing environment because you have a running business to take care of. And, quite frankly, if you are very profitable, it's harder to make people change. And I'd be interesting to hear Kjersti's perspective on that. How do you sort of maintain this notion of a burning platform?
And you said it, because I think it has a lot to do with how you communicate and how you onboard the organization as to where you are. But I like to use the word sense of urgency rather than burning platform, because burning platform, you can only keep people at a burning platform for so long, because that's a sense of a crisis. But really understanding the sense of urgency has been an extremely important part of the journey for us. And we have been doing well for many years. There's been a financial crisis and now we've had the pandemic, but broadly speaking, I mean, we're a bank that has been doing well and we've had a high pace of change. And one of the things that has changed in this latter maybe 10-year period is the need to onboard all of the organization to the sense of urgency, because innovation needs to come from within. It's not we as managers who can sit there and see what is the new technology coming. How are we going to make sure that our strategy captures the moves in the market? We need those who are closest to the problems, closest to the customers, understand how their expectations are changing, combine them with the people who has the technology knowledge and skills, and work together to have that pace, as you're saying, not reacting too late. Communicating clearly to all of the organization, understanding where we are, is important. Growing a culture and we call it empower people. I mean, managers cannot be too tight. You need innovation to grow from below. And we need to promote a culture that allows people to experiment and fail. And these are easy things to say, hard things to do in a bank that is heavily regulated. There's a lot of things you need to make sure that you get right. We have built this in several phases. First, everybody experiments and learned ways of thinking of doing innovation, trying to innovate, and gradually we have structured it more, because innovation is also about structure. Mm. You need to make sure that you don't spend all of your resources just thinking about ideas. You need to have a funnel where you actually decide on what are the things you're going to move forward on, what are the things you're actually going to execute. And in the beginning, we did, I think, as many incumbents, we had a lot of resources on the ideas, and at the end of the day, it was very few that we had the capacity to execute on. And this was a little bit what our strategy was that we launched in the pandemic. We targeted the areas where we said, where is the pace of change happening the fastest? Payments, saving, and investments. That was our priority, and we sort of scaled the execution on ideas and development in these two areas. But
yeah, I like this because we talked a little bit before this, and one of the things I very much liked to hear from you was that you said that this innovation and digitalization is not something that we're going to take 3 years and do and then we're done. You know, it's sort of on a continuous basis. And the sort of picture I have in mind, there's a computer game called Tetris. And in Tetris, you have these blocks that drop in from the top, and you have to slot them in very fast. And if you don't slot them in completely so that there are holes, then you gradually build up more and more and more, and you get less and less space to maneuver. And I use that picture to say that innovation is not about thinking what new block is coming over the horizon. Innovation is more or less about how can you get rid of as many layers, as much of the old stuff as possible, so that you actually have room to maneuver as you come in. Because banks, or you know, incumbents in many industries, are facing competition, I think, from two areas. Either very large international competitors like Alipay or Facebook, or very small, agile organizations that don't have any baggage at all and therefore are completely free to maneuver. So, that's what I think is the very, very interesting challenge, because you sort of have to change the engine while you're flying.
Then I need to ask Kerstin, your predecessor had a quote in 2018 who said, "In DNB, we are working towards becoming a technology firm with a banking license." Is that still a strategy to respond to some of the challenges you both are talking about?
I think there's no doubt that technology is only getting by the year, by the month, more and more important to our business. But technology is also an enabler to deliver products and services that, our customers need. And I often talk about what I see as a paradox. The more important technology gets, the more important our people get. But the competence, the set of competence and skill set needs to change. And we need to stop seeing the business and technology as two separate parts of the business. They are one, and together they will enable us to deliver to customers. And customers need different things. We as consumers, we need things to be easy, available, simple, that we can choose when to do. But sometimes in life, we may have needs beyond that. If you're buying your first house, for an instance, if you're going through a crisis in your life, and we want to fill both of those needs, being a bank for so many customers. If you're a global company, for example, in renewables or building infrastructure that we also do business with, your needs are completely different. But technology will be key to service both of these customers' needs. So I guess we think like a technology company. We look at what they do and how they develop their methodology to work. But we also make sure that we stick to what we're good at. And that is also linked to people's lives and their financial and economic needs.
But just to follow up on that one, also going back to your very good point about how you build the culture. So how do you develop capabilities to deal with all these challenges? How does a future banker then look like? If there is a one banker or advisor?
Well, I think there's been a huge shift in mix of competence in banks already. Now, more than 50% of the graduates we've hired over the past 50 years have a technological background. 20 years ago, we had 200-300 branches, and within every branch, we had all of the functions. I mean, now it's much more specialized. In addition to more technology people, we have more legal specialists, but what never goes away is the need to cooperate and the fact that everyone needs to be responsible for the business. I also think it's a paradox that we used to call IT a support organization. There's no way that can be the case today. I mean, they need to take ownership for the business and ownership for the customer being happy. And I like that our current IT manager, she has put on her scorecard for her organization, she has put customer satisfaction for retail customers because she wants a sense of urgency in her organization and the direct link and responsibility if the customer isn't happy about the product. What does the future look like? We need to keep our eye on the ball, and the ball is the customer. What do they need? How do we deliver what they need? Yes, we pay an eye to what our competitors are doing, more so the non-banks than the banks, and maybe more so the giants than the smaller ones, because they have a different power and they come with a different infrastructure. And we need the agility and the flexibility to move in the direction that the customers and their need takes us. I think that is more important than trying to describe exactly what the future looks like.
Mm. Well, to introduce a little bit of theory here, one of the first writers on leadership was a woman named Mary Parker Follett, and she published a book, I think, 1934, which is about how leaders give orders, or at least that was a portion in it. And she says that, I always like that sentence, as she says that, as a leader, you need to take your orders from the situation. That is, you cannot tell somebody to do something because you have the authority to do it. You do it by basically explaining that this is what the world looks like and therefore we have to do this. And then you convince the person or the organization to do something because it's the logical conclusion from what the world looks like. Now, if you systematize that, you see that in lots of organizations today. Schibsted is one example. That sort of translates into a mode of very, very disciplined experimentation. And a sort of central point there is that when innovation happens, it doesn't happen because somebody comes up with a suggestion that is presented to a group of managers, and then the decision is made, do we do it or not? What has happened is somebody comes up with a suggestion, you test it out there on the customer interface, or in a way by giving some customers this option and some customers not this option, and see what works best. And then, in a sense, you take your order from the situation. And I think that's a very interesting aspect of trying to change an incumbent, and perhaps, you know, at the core of it, technology or not, that we need to sort of understand the situation and take our orders from that.
And we've been doing this this for years, in particular in on the retail side, and also more and more on the SME side, actually innovating together with our customers. Vipps is doing that as well, and this is a capability that has come with having all of our customer facing channels in the cloud, because it's a it's not that many years ago. We probably had two big releases a year, and that was when something changed for our customers. Now that happens every week, and we have multiple changes every week and multiple changes every month, and many of them are experimenting, trying out things together with our customers, it is innovation is more structure than most people think, of course you're not testing everything either, but having a funnel that takes you through the various steps of innovation is important, because innovating is also about choice. If you try to do everything, you probably won't succeed. And that is part of the challenge in a world where you see threats coming from everywhere. You, potentially anyone could offer any service to a certain extent. And if you try to move on anything that moves, you'll probably spread your resources too thin.
You're the chairman of Vipps, and you also mentioned that the payment system is one of the areas which are within great changes. And you recently announced a merger with MobilePay, so you're undoubtedly a very strong payments provider in the Nordics. But international players, Apple Pay or whoever it is, are knocking on the door. So how do you compete against global tech companies like that?
You have to be better. I mean, deliver what the customers want. I think one of the keystone philosophy of Vipps is simplifying people's lives, making it easy, simple, and attractive. I think I can't say that they have been good at this in the past, but this is something they try to do better every day. And Vipps was built in 6 months. That was a real experiment for us. We sort of put it on the side of the existing business, prioritized it over everything else, and said, this is something we need to do, and we need to do it today, or we should have done it yesterday. It had attractive features that made it scale to 1 million people by the first year. And it has the network effects where you need more and more people to have it. I can't remember how many people I sent 5 kroners to, because that made them download the app, and then they were onto it. Staying true to the core of simplification, making it easy. Payments is a hassle. People aren't looking for the payment situation in itself. They're looking to buy something. How do you simplify it? How do you make it available in a better way? And of course, there's going to be competition on this, but Vipps has built Norway's best liked brand. So there's more than also the experience, is also the sensation that you've created around Vipps. You can never rest on that in a market that is innovating so quickly. So they just have to move and improve by the day.
I'm tempted to tell a little story. Some years ago, I was teaching in India, and one of my students, very, very smart students, and one of my students said, "So how many people live in Norway?" And I said, "Well, we're just reached 5 million. And he started laughing, and then he said, "Are you aware that if we do a census, if we count the population of India, the margin of error is plus minus 5 million? Which means that if we moved the whole of Norway to India, we could not statistically prove that we're there." And I think that's one of the challenges when you start moving into payment systems and platforms like Vipps, that, you know, Norway is an exceedingly digital society. I mean, our cash rate, how many of the payments are being done in cash, is below 10%.
3%. It's half during the pandemic, from 6 to 3.
Yeah, I literally can't remember the last time I used cash. And that might be somewhat the situation in Denmark, but not quite so much, and Sweden, and so on and so forth. But as you get further down on the continent, that's not the case anymore. You go to Germany and they won't take your credit card at the bakery. And I think that's one of the challenges, because Vipps sort of sewed up the Norwegian market, and it can only be one player in every market. And then now it's spread to the Nordics. But I think the challenge of moving further out and becoming a European brand, which will be necessary in order to withstand the Facebooks and the Alipays and the WeChat wallet and whoever comes in, PayPal, you know, of the world. And then you reach into a situation where the level of digitalization and the sense of urgency is very different in different countries. If you look at a bank like Nordea, which is, you know, is pan-Nordic. One of their challenges in moving rapidly into digitalization has been that the level and the urgency and the customer interface is different in the different countries. So I think, you know, it's very, very interesting to see, because Vipps, you know, Norway is special in some ways. If you see the number of Teslas driving around in the streets of Oslo, and, you know, the fact that every street beggar has his or her telephone number, so that you can Vipps them money because nobody has cash anymore. That simply isn't the situation in the rest of the world. And one of the challenges, I think, to the banking industry, not to mention Vipps, is that the market may not be that mature in the other countries.
That is true, but every market is in its journey and the world is not static. And I certainly believe that the sense of urgency in relation to the need to digitize has risen substantially in Europe during the pandemic, because one of the reasons why the Norwegian economy has been doing particularly well is also how advanced we are in digital. And cash is increasingly a problem. I mean, you see the topic of digital central bank money coming in every corner of the world. In some corners of the world, like ours, it's coming because we need to have backup money, and we want to have some sort of privacy where you can't digitally trace the money, and you want to give people an opportunity to have a direct exposure on the central bank, even though I don't think most people think about that's actually what they have when they use real cash to pay with. But you don't need to go farther than Germany to see that cash is actually an issue. It's too much cash. Mm. It's expensive. It's not it's not practical. And I don't think sort of the black economy is a particular issue in Germany, but in other countries it is. So there's a lot of priorities that pushes you to go in a direction of digitization, and one of the keys in Norway has been also the public sector. So the direction we're going in is for also Europe to become more digitized. I think also the banks will be forced to become more digital. I think you look at the Nordic banks, you compare them to the European banks, they have close to half the relative cost ratio because they have seized the opportunity of being digital. And we don't see ourselves as passive players in this. I mean, building Vipps is driving behavior. Mm. So we shouldn't, of course, you need to understand your relative power of impact. Mm. But we certainly believe that we have an impact, and that VIPs has an impact and have changed people's behavior.
So VIPs can become a global player.
VIPs can become a global player. It's not sort of, we've expressed that our strategy now is the Nordics, and then we have been curious about Europe. We have a leading position in payment technology and payment infrastructure in the Nordics. And of course, it's going to be many other players who's looking for it. I'm not sure there can only be one player in each market on the payment side. But of course, there's a limit to how many it can be. Doing payments is also easier in theory than in practice.
I agree. Let's change the tack slightly. You also alluded to it, Kerstin, about sustainability. So how does an institution like yourself tackle the climate-related risk related to individual customers, the bank itself, the portfolio, and the society at large? How do you deal with that?
Well, I think this is one of the core issues that we all have to work on. We need to make sure that climate is only one aspect of sustainability, but the UN's 17 sustainable goals are all important to us. And we have taken a look, we support all of them, but we've taken a look at them and said, what are the areas where we can make the biggest impact? And of course, we can see this in a risk perspective, but we can also see it in a opportunity impact business perspective, and I'm going to focus on the second one. Before moving on to climate, diversity, gender, and equality is an area that we've worked on for a long time, and I think accessing the right competence, that is certainly going to be key in order to succeed also in the future. Secondly, climate. Norway has a high agenda to transition our composition of our business environment. We have a large sector of oil and gas that has given us a lot of wealth and contributed to our quality of life in the current society. But we know that over time, this needs to be a lesser part of our economy, and we need to build new industries. It also happens that the new industries that we see as ensuring energy balance are industries where we have a good starting point in terms of competence. Renewable energy, we have all our power from water, wind and sun, but in particular wind, we can use the offshore competence that we have. And hydrogen, we have a good starting point also with the cheap energy that we can produce in Norway. We have a role in all of this, and we have said that we want to be an accelerator. Many banks have gone and said that they want to exit anything that can't be defined as green. We don't believe that solves anything. We need to work with the companies in their transition plan, and we need to prioritize funding of the sectors that are going to grow. So we have set targets in both of these areas. We will reduce the emissions from our portfolios within oil and gas and the maritime sectors, and we will finance or enable financing of 1,500 billion kroner into sustainable financings by the year of 2030. That is equal to our total balance sheet today. So that's a huge number.
Espen, listening to the CEO of DNB, she's faced with the global challenges of the economy. She's faced with global competition, local competition, the fintechs. She's faced actually with also the whole the world challenges. And she's probably not the only one, even though she's running the biggest bank in Norway. How should leaders think in trying to comprehend and structure and deal with all these challenges in a simple way?
My usual answer to that is that if I had known that, I wouldn't be teaching, I would be doing it. But that certainly is very complicated. It's almost impossible not to answer a question like that at a personal level. So, you know, because you how you structure things. And I used to be to work with leaders of technology in very large American organizations for many years. What was common with all of them, and that, you know, might be an interesting answer. You obviously can't do this yourself. So how do you find people who can help you? I'm currently engaged in educating students that know business and technology, specifically not just at BI, but also at the University of Oslo. And the one big problem is there isn't enough of them. There isn't enough people who know technology, which causes us to go all over the world to look for them, and that creates its own challenge inside an organization. There certainly isn't enough people who understand business, and in particular, there is not enough people who can serve as bridge builders between the two. And this transition to technology being part of a business and innovation being a continuing process will necessitate changes in need of competence. And if you can't find them, how are you going to build them? So that's what I would be thinking about.
Fight for talent, is it, Kjersti?
It is fight for talent, and certainly that is on its way up in certain areas, because we're all going to be looking for the same type of competence. For example, cybersecurity, that is going to be relevant to all types of businesses. But it's also about developing people. That's what I hear Espen talking about, and not only during the times where you are a full-time student, but also when you work. I actually had, the release of our annual and fourth quarter results last week, and we gave an extended presentation to our investors, and I talked about three topics. And for the first time, this was one of the topics that we talked about in an investor setting. It's not the most talked about. It's usually very hardcore, very numbers, very, very, very graph oriented. But I talked about sense of urgency, or not the sense of urgency, but the importance of having the right people and working in order to make sure that you were attractive, competitive, and offering development and growth of your people. That's probably the one criteria that I would list the highest as the most important criteria to succeed. I'm not even thinking about it in the way that I'm looking for people to help me. I'm always looking for people that are better than me, and there are tons of them. A bridge from what we just talked about, I mean, sustainability, because it's hard to talk about sustainability because it's really integrated into our thinking and everything that we do. And this matters to people. That is part of what is making us one of the most attractive employers in Norway. People want to contribute with something that they see meaningful. I know one of the professors at Stanford has talked about the competence that you gain or the learning that you've had. I mean, it's halved in 3 years. Just a mirror saying that it doesn't mean that you shouldn't study, but it's just the pace of the need for renewal of competence. You can't just have a learning phase and then thinking that you'll do rest of your work just deploying that competence. And to pick up on what Espen said earlier, I think Norway's certainly going to lack people. We are only 5 million people, and we have too large part of the workforce that is not taking part. We need to find ways of mobilizing that, and we need to find ways of increasing the cooperation and interaction between academia and business life, because the learning and continuous development needs to be integrated in many more of our people's lives in order to keep track and develop at the pace that the business needs.
And I know that's close to your heart, Espen, about further education and interaction between business and universities as a continuous learning through the years.
Absolutely. We have many challenges in academia. One of them is that left to ourselves, we tend to move in directions that are more and more esoteric, more and more advanced, and we need to have somebody that claws us back and demands relevance from us again. And that means relevance not just in what we do research on, but also relevance in how we communicate it and train people for that.
Time is running, but one of the aims we have is to produce good raw materials to you, good students who have the
much appreciated
capability to be trained further by you. And hopefully we can also be a part of developing interactively through the life of the employment they have with institutions like yourself. And I think that's one of the key learnings I took away today is how do we get that better working? But also the way you very well explain that IT or digitalization, sustainability, and business acumen, it all is one integrated unit. It's not separate parts. And how do we teach ourselves and students to think that way, and more importantly, employees going forward? Time is running. So what does the next couple of years hold for you and DNB? What's on the highest agenda, except the things we've spoken about?
Well, making even better products and services and experience for our customers. I mean, that's what makes us go up in the morning, and that's what excites all of the organization. And I think one of the things that has been extremely powerful for many of the people working in DNB during the pandemic is actually seeing the importance of the role that we can play in people's life. When everything is working, you don't think about it. But in March 2020, when so many businesses lost all of their revenue from one day to the other, many people had to stop working temporarily and started to worry. We saw the power of some of the things that we've done in the recent years. For example, people who needed to postpone their payments on their house mortgage. Usually before the pandemic, we had 100 applications a week, and we scaled it to servicing 100 applications by the hour when we were able to deploy the technology and scale the pace. And we use this as an inspiration. We have more of these opportunities and potentials to fill, and that's what we're going to chase and deliver on.
With those remarks, thank you very much for joining us, Kjerstin and Espen. And to your listeners, I hope you enjoyed it. And until next time, have a good week. Thank you.
This is a BI production. Listen to more podcasts. Go to bi.no/podcasts.